the wooden bowl of crusts. Grandmother, back in the hut, sat down again to the crusts, and Sasha and Motka, perched on the stove, looked at her and saw with joy that she was drinking milk during fast time, and therefore would go to hell. Consoled by this, they lay down to sleep, and Sasha, going off to sleep, imagined the terrible chastisement. A big stove, like the potter's, and a black unclean spirit, horned like a cow, drove Grandmother into the stove with a long stick, as she herself had lately driven the geese. Chapter 5. Fire. On the night of Assumption, at 11 o'clock, the young men and girls playing below in the meadow suddenly cried and shrieked and ran back towards the village. The boys and girls who sat above on the brink of the ravine at first couldn't understand the cause of their cries. "Fire! Fire!" came from beneath in a despairing scream. "The hut's on fire!" The boys and girls on the ravine turned their heads and saw a picture terrible and rare. Over one of the farthest thatched huts rose a fathom-high pillar of fire which curled and scattered fountain-wise on all sides showers of bright sparks. And immediately afterwards the whole roof caught fire, and the crackling of burning beams was heard by all. The moonlight faded, and soon the whole village was bathed in a red, trembling glare. Black shadows moved across the ground, and there was a smell of burning. The merrymakers from below, all panting, speechless, shuddering, jostled one another and fell. Dazzled by the bright light, they saw nothing, and couldn't even tell who was who. The sight was terrible, and most terrible of all was that in the smoke above the conflagration fluttered doves, and that the men in the inn, knowing nothing of the fire, continued to sing and play the concertina as if nothing had happened. "Uncle Semyon is burning!" cried a loud, hoarse voice. Marya, with chattering teeth, wandered about her hut weeping and wringing her hands, although the fire was far away at the other end of the village. Nikolai came out in his felt boots, and after him the children in their shirts. At the village policeman's hut they beat the alarm. Bem, bem, bem echoed through the air, and this tireless, repeated sound made the hearts sink and the listeners turn cold. The old women stood about with images. From the yards were driven sheep, calves, and cows, and the villagers carried into the street their boxes, sheepskins, and pails. A black stallion, kept apart from the herd because he kicked and injured the horses, found himself in freedom, and neighing loudly, he tore up and down the village, and at last stopped beside a cart and kicked it violently. In the church beyond the river, the fire alarm was rung. It was hot all around the burning hut, and in the bright glare even the blades of grass were visible. On a box which the peasants had managed to save sat Semyon, a big-nosed, red-headed mujik, in short coat, with a forage cap pressed down to his ears. His wife lay on her face on the earth and groaned. A little, big-bearded, capless, gnome-like stranger of 80, evidently partial to fires, wandered around carrying a white bundle. His bald head reflected the glare. The starosta, Antip Sedyelnikov, swarthy and black-haired as a gypsy, went up to the hut with his axe and, for no apparent reason, beat in all the windows and began to hack at the steps. "Women! Water!" he roared. "Bring the engine! Look sharp!" The peasants, fresh from merrymaking in the inn, dragged up the fire engine. All were drunk. They staggered and fell. Their expressions were helpless, and tears stood in their eyes. "Bring water, girls!" cried the starosta, also drunk. "Look sharp!" The young women and girls ran down the slope to the well, returned with pails and pitchers of water, and having emptied them into the engine, ran back for more. Olga and Marya and Sasha and Motka all helped. The water was pumped up by women and small boys. The hose nozzle hissed, and the starosta, aiming it now at the door, now at the windows, held his finger on the stream of water so that it hissed still more fiercely. "Good man, Antip!" came approving cries. "Keep it up!" And Antip went into the hall and cried thence, "Bring more water! Do your best, orthodox men and women, on this unfortunate occasion!" The mujik stood in a crowd with idle hands and gaped at the fire. No one knew what to start on. Not one was capable of help. Although around were stacks of grain, hay, outhouses, and heaps of dry brushwood. Kiryak and his father Osip, both tipsy, stood in the crowd. As if to excuse his idleness, the old man turned to the woman who lay on the ground and said, "Don't worry yourself, gossip. The hut's insured. It's all the same to you." And Semyon, addressing each mujik in turn, explained how the hut caught fire. "That old man there with the bundle is General Zhukov's servant. He was with our general, heaven kingdom to him, as cook. He comes up to us in the evening and begins, 'Let me sleep here tonight.' We had a drink each, of course. The woman prepared the samovar to get the old man tea, when, in an unlucky moment, she put it in the hall, and the fire from the chimney, of course, went up to the roof, the straw and all. We were nearly burnt ourselves, and the old man lost his cap. It's a pity." The fire alarm boomed without cease, and the bells of the church across the river rang again and again. Olga, panting, bathed in the glare, looked with terror at the red sheep and the red pigeons flying about in the smoke. And it seemed to her that the boom of the fire alarm pierced into her soul, that the fire would last forever, and that Sasha was lost. And when the roof crashed in, she grew so weak with fear lest the whole village burn that she could no longer carry water, and she sat on the brink of the ravine with her pail beside her. Beside her sat other women, and spoke as if they were speaking of a corpse. At last from the manor house came two cartloads of workmen. They brought with them a fire engine. A very youthful student in white, unbuttoned tunic rode into the village on horseback. Axes crashed, a ladder was placed against the burning log walls, and up it promptly climbed five men led by the student, who was very red and shouted sharply and hoarsely and in a tone which implied that he was well accustomed to extinguishing fires. They took the hut to pieces, beam by beam, and dragged apart stall, the wattle fence, and the nearest herrick. "Don't let them break it!" came angry voices from the crowd. "Don't let them!" Kiryak, with a resolute face, went into the hut as if to prevent the newcomers breaking, but one of the workmen turned him back with a blow on the neck. Kiryak tumbled, and on all fours crept back to the crowd. From across the river came two pretty girls in hats, the student's sisters, no doubt. They stood some way off and watched the conflagration. The scattered logs no longer burned, but smoked fiercely, and the student, handling the hose, sent the water sometimes on the logs, sometimes into the crowd, sometimes at the women who were carrying pails. "Georgi!" cried the frightened girls reproachfully. "Georgi!" The fire ended. Before the crowd dispersed, the dawn had begun, and all faces were pale and a little dark, or so it always seems in early morning when the last stars fade away. As they went to their homes, the mujiks laughed and joked at the expense of General Zhukov's cook and his burnt cap. They reenacted the fire as a joke, and, it seemed, were sorry it had come so quickly to an end. "You put out the fire beautifully, sir," said Olga to the student. "Quite in the Moscow way. There we have fires every day." "Are you really from Moscow?" asked one of the girls. "Yes. My husband served in the Slavyansky Bazaar, and this is my little girl." She pointed to Sasha, who pressed close to her from the cold. "Also from Moscow, miss." The girls spoke to the student in French, and handed Sasha a 20-kopeck piece. When old Ossip saw this, his face grew bright with hope.
"Thank God, Your Honor, there was no wind," he said, turning to the student. "We'd have been all burnt up in an hour. Your Honor, good gentleman," he added shamefacedly, "it's a cold morning. We want warming badly. A half a bottle from your kindness."
Ossip's hint proved vain, and, grunting, he staggered home. Olga stood at the end of the village and watched as the two carts forded the stream, and the pretty girls walked through the meadow towards the carriage waiting on the other side. She turned to the hut in ecstasies. "And such nice people, so good-looking. The young ladies, just like little cherubs."
"May they burst asunder," growled sleepy Fiekla, angrily.
Chapter 6 The Hut. Maria was unhappy, and said that she wanted to die. But life as she found it was quite to Fiekla's taste. She liked the poverty and the dirt and the never-ceasing bad language. She ate what she was given without picking and choosing, and could sleep comfortably anywhere. She emptied the slops in front of the steps, threw them, in fact, from the threshold, though in her own naked feet she had to walk through the puddle. And from the first day she hated Olga and Nikolai, for no reason save that they loathed this life.
"We'll see what you're going to eat here, my nobles from Moscow," she said maliciously. "We'll see."
Once on an early September morning, Fiekla, rosy from the cold, healthy and good-looking, carried up the hill two pails of water. When she entered the hut, Maria and Olga sat at the table and drank tea.
"Tea and sugar," began Fiekla, ironically. "Fine ladies you are," she added, setting down the pails. "A nice fashion you've got of drinking tea every day. See that you don't swell up with tea," she continued, looking with hatred at Olga. "You've got a thick snout already in Moscow, fat beef."
She swung round the yoke and struck Olga on the shoulder. The two women clapped their hands and exclaimed, "Ach, Batyushki!" After which Fiekla returned to the river to wash clothes, and all the time cursed so loudly that she was heard in the hut. The day passed, and behind it came the long autumn evening. All sat winding silk, except Fiekla, who went down to the river. The silk was given out by a neighboring factory, and at this work the whole family earned not more than 20 kopecks a week.
"We were better off as serfs," said the old man, winding away busily. "In those days you'd work and eat and sleep, each in its turn. For dinner you'd have shchi and porridge, and for supper again shchi and porridge. Gherkins and cabbage as much as you liked. And you'd eat freely, as much as you liked. And there was more order. Each man knew his place."
The one lamp in the hut burned dimly and smoked. When any worker rose and passed the lamp, a black shadow fell on the window, and the bright moonlight shone in. Old Ossip related slowly how the peasants lived before the emancipation, how in these same villages, where all today lived penuriously, there were great shooting parties, and on such days the mujiks were treated to vodka without end, how whole trains of carts with game for the young squire were hurried off to Moscow, how the wicked were punished with rods or exiled to the estate in Tver, and the good were rewarded. And grandmother also spoke. She remembered everything. She told of her old mistress, a good, God-fearing woman with a wicked, dissolute husband, and of the queer marriages made by all the daughters. One, it appeared, married a drunkard, another a petty tradesman, and the third was carried off clandestinely. She, grandmother, then unmarried, helped in the adventure. and all soon afterwards died of grief, as did, indeed, their mother. And, remembering these events, grandmother began to cry. When a knock was heard at the door, all started.
"Uncle Ossip, let me stay the night."
Into the hut came the little, bald old man, General Zhukov's cook, whose cap was burnt in the fire. He sat and listened and, like his hosts, related many strange happenings. Nikolai, his legs hanging over the stove, listened, and asked what sort of food was eaten at the manor house. They spoke of bitki, cutlets, soups of various kinds and sauces, and the cook, who too had an excellent memory, named certain dishes which no one eats nowadays. There was a dish, for instance, made of ox eyes, and called Awake in the Morning.
"And did you cook cutlets, Maréchal?" asked Nikolai.
"No."
Nikolai shook his head reproachfully and said, "Then you are a queer sort of cook." The little girls sat and lay on the stove and looked down with widely opened eyes. There seemed to be no end to them, like cherubs in the sky. The stories delighted them. They sighed, shuddered, and turned pale, sometimes from rapture, sometimes from fear. And, breathless, afraid to move, they listened to the stories of their grandmother, which were the most interesting of all. They went to bed in silence, and the old men, agitated by their stories, thought how glorious was youth, which, however meager it might be, left behind it only joyful, living, touching recollections. And how terribly cold was this death, which was now so near. Better not think of it. The lamp went out, and the darkness, the two windows, bright with moonshine, the silence, the cradle's creak somehow reminded them that life was now past, and that it would never return. They slumbered, lost consciousness. Then suddenly someone jostled their shoulders or breathed into their cheeks, and there was no real sleep. Through their heads crept thoughts of death. They turned round and forgot about death, but their heads were full of old, mean, tedious thoughts, thoughts of need, of forage, of the rise in the price of flour. And again they remembered that life had now passed by, and that it would never return.
"Oh, Lord," sighed the cook.
Someone tapped cautiously at the window. That must be Fiekla. Olga rose, yawned, muttered a prayer, opened the inner door, then drew the bolt in the hall. But no one entered. A draught blew, and the moon shone brightly. Through the open door, Olga saw the quiet and deserted street, and the moon itself swimming high in the sky. "Who's there?" she cried.
"I," came a voice. "It's I."
Near the door, pressing close to the wall, stood Fiekla, naked as she was born. She shuddered from the cold, her teeth chattered, and in the bright moonlight she was pale, pretty, and strange. The patches of shade and the moonlight on her skin stood out sharply. And plainest of all stood out her dark eyebrows and her young, firm breast.
"Some impudent fellows across the river undressed me and sent me off in this way, as my mother bore me. Bring me something to put on."
"Go into the hut yourself," whispered Olga with a shudder. "The old ones will see me."
And as a fact, grandmother got restless and growled, and the old man asked,
"Who is there?"
Olga brought out her shirt and petticoat and dressed Fiekla. And the two women, softly and doing their best to close the doors without notice,
went into the hut.
"So that's you, devil?"
came an angry growl from Grandmother, who guessed it was Thekla.
"May you be, Nightwalker. There's no peace with you."
"Don't mind, don't mind," whispered Olga, wrapping Thekla up. "Don't mind, my heart." Again, silence. The whole family always slept badly. Each was troubled by something aggressive and insistent. The old man by a pain in the back, Grandmother by worry and ill temper, Maria by fright, the children by itching and hunger. And tonight the sleep of all was troubled. They rolled from side to side, wandered, and rose constantly to drink. Thekla suddenly cried out in a loud, rough voice, but soon mastered herself and merely sobbed quietly until at last she ceased. Now and then from beyond the river were heard the church chimes, but the clock struck strangely, and at first beat struck five, and later three.
"Oh, Lord," sighed the cook.
From the light in the windows, it was hard to judge whether the moon still shone or whether dawn had come. Maria rose and went out, and she was heard milking the cows and shouting, "Stand!" Grandmother also went out. It was still dark in the hut, but everything could be seen. Nikolai, who had spent a sleepless night, climbed down from the stove. He took from a green box his evening dress coat, put it on, and going over to the window, smoothed the sleeves and the folds, and smiled. Then he took off the coat, returned it to the box, and lay down. Maria returned and began to light the stove. Apparently she was not yet quite awake. Probably she still dreamed of something, or recalled the stories of last night, for she stretched herself lazily before the stove and said,
"No, we're better in freedom."
Chapter 7. Who Else? In the village arrived the gentleman, as the peasants called the superintendent of police. Everyone knew a week ahead the day and cause of his arrival, for though Zhukovo had only 40 houses, it owed in arrears to the imperial treasury and the zemstvo more than 2,000 rubles. The superintendent stopped at the inn, drank two glasses of tea, and then walked to the starosta's hut, where already waited a crowd of peasants in arrears. The starosta, Antip Sedyelnikov, despite his youth, he was little over 30, was a stern man who always took the side of the authorities, although he himself was poor and paid his taxes irregularly. It was clear to all that he was flattered by his position and reveled in the sense of power which he had no other way of displaying save by sternness. The Mir feared and listened to him. When in the street or at the inn he met a drunken man, he would seize him, tie his hands behind his back, and put him in the village jail. Once, indeed, he even imprisoned Grandmother for several days because, appearing at the Mir instead of her husband, she used abusive language. The starosta had never lived in town and read no books, but he had a copious collection of learned words and used them so liberally that people respected him, even when they didn't understand. When Osip with his tax book entered the starosta's hut, the superintendent, a thin, old, gray-whiskered man in a gray coat, sat at a table in the near corner and made notes in a book. The hut was clean, the walls were decorated with pictures from magazines, and in a prominent place near the icon hung a portrait of Alexander of Battenberg, ex-prince of Bulgaria. At the table, with crossed arms, stood Antip Sidnyelnikov. "This man, your honor, owes 119 rubles," he said when it came to Osip's turn. "Before Holy Week he paid a ruble. Since then, nothing."
The superintendent turned his eyes on Osip and asked,
"What's the reason of that, brother?"
"Your Honor, be merciful to me,"
began Osip in agitation.
"Let me explain. This summer, Squire Litoryetsky, Osip, he says, 'Sell me your hay.' 'Sell it,' he says. 'I had 100 puds for sale, which the women mowed. Well, we bargained. All went well, without friction.'"
He complained of the starosta, and now and again turned to the mujiks as if asking for support. His flushed face sweated, and his eyes turned bright and vicious.
"I don't understand why you tell me all that," said the superintendent. "I ask you, it's you I ask, why you don't pay your arrears. None of you pay, and I am held responsible."
"I'm not able to."
"These expressions are without consequence, Your Honor," said the starosta pompously. "In reality, the Chikildyeyevs belong to the impoverished class, but be so good as to ask the others what is the reason. Vodka and impudence, without any comprehension."
The superintendent made a note, and said to Osip in a quiet, even voice, as if he were asking for water, "Begone." Soon afterwards he drove away. And as he sat in his cheap tarantas and coughed, it was plain, even from the appearance of his long, thin back, that he had forgotten Osip, and the starosta, and the arrears of Zhukovo, and was thinking of his own domestic affairs. He had hardly covered a verst before Antip Sednyelnikov was carrying off the Chikildyeyev's samovar, and after him ran grandmother, and whined like a dog, "I won't give it! I won't give it to you! Accursed!" The starosta walked quickly, taking big steps, and grandmother, stooping and fierce and breathless, tottered after him, and her green-gray hair floated in the wind. At last she stopped, beat her breast with her fists, and exclaimed with a whine and a sob, "Orthodox men who believe in God! Batyushki, they're wronging me! Kinsmen, they've robbed me! Oy, oy, will no one help me?"
"Grandmother, grandmother," said the starosta severely, "have some reason in your head."
With the loss of the samovar, things in the Chikildyeyev's hut grew even worse. There was something humiliating and shameful in this last privation, and it seemed that the hut had suddenly lost its honor. The table itself, the chairs, and all the pots, had the starosta seized them, would have been less missed. Grandmother screamed, Marya cried, and the children, listening, began to cry also. The old man, with a feeling of guilt, sat gloomily in the corner and held his tongue. And Nikolai was silent. As a rule, grandmother liked him and pitied him, but at this crisis her pity evaporated, and she cursed and reproached him, and thrust her fists under his nose. She screamed that he was guilty of the family's misfortunes, and asked why he had sent so little home, though he boasted in his letters that he earned 50 rubles a month at the Slavyansky Bazaar. Why did he come home, and still worse, bring his family? If he died, whence would the money come for his funeral? And it was painful to look at Nikolai, Olga, and Sasha. The old man grunted, took his cap, and went to the starostas. It was getting dark. Antip Sednyelnikov, with cheeks puffed out, stood at the stove and soldered. It was stifling. His children, skinny and unwashed, not better than the Chikildyeyevs, sprawled on the floor. His ugly, freckled wife wound silk. This, too, was an unhappy, God-forsaken family. Alone, Antip was smart and good-looking. On a bench in a row stood 5 samovars. The old man prayed towards the Battenberg prince and began,
"Antip, show the mercy of God. Give me the samovar. For the love of God.
Bring me 3 rubles, and then you'll get it."
"I haven't got them."
Antip puffed out his cheeks. The fire hummed and hissed, and the samovars shone. The old man fumbled with his cap, thought a moment, and repeated,
"Give it to me."
The swarthy starosta seemed quite black and resembled a wizard. He turned to Osip and said roughly and quickly, "All depends from the rural chief. In the administrative session of the 26th of this month, you can expose the causes of your dissatisfaction verbally or in writing." Not one of these learned words was understood by Osip, but he felt contented and returned to his hut. 10 days later, the superintendent returned, stayed about an hour, and drove away. It had turned windy and cold, but though the river was frozen, there was no snow, and the state of the roads was a torture to everyone. On Sunday evening, the neighbors looked in to see and talk with Osip. They spoke in the darkness. To work was a sin, and no one lighted the lamp. News was exchanged, chiefly disagreeable. 3 houses away, the hens had been taken in payment of arrears and sent to the cantonal office, and there they died of starvation. Sheep had also been taken, and while they were being driven away, tied with ropes and transferred to fresh carts at each village, one had died. And now they discussed the question. Who was responsible?
"The Zemstvo," said Osip. "Who else?"
"Of course, the Zemstvo." They accused the Zemstvo of everything, of arrears, of oppression, of famines, although not one of them knew exactly what the Zemstvo was. And that rule had been observed since wealthy peasants with factories, shops, and houses were elected as Zemstvo members, and being discontented with the institution, thenceforth in their factories and inns, abused the Zemstvo. They complained of the fact that God had sent no snow, and that though it was time to lay in firewood, you could neither drive nor walk upon the frozen roads. 15 years before, and earlier, the small talk of Zhukovo was infinitely more entertaining. In those days every old man pretended he held some secret, knew something, and waited for something. They talked of rescripts with gold seals, redistribution of lands and hidden treasures, and hinted of things mysterious. Today, the people of Zhukovo had no secrets. Their life was open to all. And they had no themes for conversation save need and forage and the absence of snow. For a moment they were silent. But soon they remembered the hens and dead sheep and returned to the problem. Who was responsible?
"The Zemstvo," said Osip gloomily. "Who else?"
Chapter 8. Died. The parish church was Kosogorovo, 6 versts away. But the peasants went there only to christen, marry, or bury. They worshipped at the church across the river. On Sundays, when the weather was fine, the village girls dressed in their best and went in a crowd to the service. And the red, yellow, and green dresses fluttering across the meadow were pleasant to see. In bad weather, all stayed at home. They fasted, prayed, and prepared for the sacrament. From those who had failed in this duty during the great fast, the priest, when he went round the huts with his crucifix, took 15 kopecks fine. The old man didn't believe in God, because he had hardly ever thought of him. He admitted the supernatural, but held that that was an affair for women. And when others spoke of religion or of miracles, and asked him questions on the subject, he scratched himself and said reluctantly,
"Who knows anything about it?"
Grandmother believed vaguely. In her mind, all things were confused, and when she began to meditate on death and salvation, Hunger and poverty took the upper hand, and she forgot her meditations. She remembered no prayers, but at night before lying down, she stood before the icons and muttered,
"Mother of God of Kazan, Mother of God of Smolensk, three-handed Mother of God."
Marya and Fyekla crossed themselves and fasted, but knew nothing of religion. They neither taught their children to pray nor spoke to them of God, and they taught them no principles, save that they must not eat meat during fasts. With the other villagers it was the same. Few believed, and few understood. Nevertheless, all loved the scriptures, loved them dearly and piously. The misfortune was that there were no books and no one to read and explain, so that when Olga read aloud the gospel, she was treated with respect, and all addressed her and her daughter Sasha with the polite form of you. At church festivals, Olga often walked to neighboring villages and even to the district town, where there were 2 monasteries and 27 churches. She was abstracted, and as she walked on her pilgrimage, forgot her family. When she returned home, it seemed that she had only just discovered her husband and daughter, and she smiled and said radiantly, "God has sent us his mercy." Everything that happened in the village repelled and tormented her. On Elijah's day, they drank. At Assumption, they drank. At Elevation, they drank. At intercession, Zhukova had its parish festival, and this the Mujiks observed by drinking for 3 days. They drank 50 rubles from the communal funds, and then went around the huts and collected money for more vodka. On the first days, the Chikildeyevs killed a ram, and ate mutton in the morning, at dinner, and for supper. And in the night, all the children got out of bed to eat more. Kiriak was drunk all 3 days. He drank away his cap and boots, and beat Marya so badly that she had to be soused with water. And then all were sick with shame. Despite this, even this Zhukovo, this Choluyevka, had once a real religious festival. That was in August, when through every village in the district was born the life-giving icon. The day it was due at Zhukovo was windless and dull. Early in the morning, the village girls, in their bright holiday dress, set out to meet the icon, which arrived at evening with a procession and singing. And at that moment the church bells rang loudly. A vast crowd from Zhukovo and neighboring villages filled the street. There were noise, dust, and crushing, and the old man, grandmother, and Kiriak all stretched out their hands to the icon, looked at it greedily, and cried with tears, "Intercessor, mother, intercessor!" All, at once, it seemed, realized that there is no void between earth and heaven, that the great and strong of this world have not seized upon everything, that there is intercession against injury, against slavish subjection, against heavy, intolerable need, against the terrible vodka. "Intercessor, mother," sobbed Marya, "mother." When the service was said and the icon carried away, all things were as of old, and noisy, drunken voices echoed from the inn. Death was dreaded only by the wealthy Mujiks. The richer they grew, the less their faith in God and in salvation. And only out of fear of the end of the world, to make certain, so to speak, they lighted candles in the church and said Mass. The poorer Mujiks knew no fear of death. They told the old man and grandmother to their faces that they had lived their day, that it was high time to die, and the old man and grandmother listened indifferently. They didn't scruple to tell Fyekla in Nikolai's presence that when he, Nikolai, died, her husband, Denis, would get his discharge from the army and be sent home. And Marya not only had no fear of death, but was even sorry that it lingered. And she rejoiced when her own children died. but though they knew no dread of death, they looked on sickness with exaggerated dread. The most trifling ailment, a disordered stomach, a slight chill, sent grandmother on to the stove, where she rolled herself up and groaned loudly without cease, "I'm dying!" And the old man would send for the priest to confess her and administer the last sacrament. They talked eternally of colds, of worms, of tumors which begin in the stomach and slowly creep towards the heart. Most of all, they dreaded colds, and even in summer dressed warmly and cowered over the stove. Grandmother loved medical treatment, and constantly drove to hospital, where she said she was 58 instead of 70, for she feared that if the doctor knew her age, he would refuse to treat her, and would tell her it was time to die. She usually started for the hospital at early morning, taking a couple of the little girls, and returned at night, hungry and ill-tempered, with a mixture for herself and ointments for the girls. Once she took with her Nikolai, who for the next 2 weeks dosed himself with a mixture and said that he felt better. Grandmother knew every doctor, felcher, and wise woman within 30 versts, and disapproved of all. At intercession, when the priest made his round of the huts with a crucifix, the clerk told her that near the town prison there was an old man, formerly an army felcher, who doctored cleverly, and he advised grandmother to see him. She took the advice. When the first snow fell, she drove into town and brought back an old bearded Jew in a long kaftan whose whole face was covered with blue veins. At that time journeymen worked in the hut. An old tailor in terrifying spectacles made a waistcoat out of rags, and two young lads made felt for top boots. Kiryak, dismissed for drunkenness and now living at home, sat beside the tailor and mended a horse collar. The hut was close and smoky. The Jew looked at Nikolai and said that he must be bled. He applied leeches, and the old tailor, Kiryak, and the little girls looked on and imagined they saw the disease coming out of Nikolai. And Nikolai also watched the leeches sucking his chest, and saw them fill with dark blood, and feeling that, indeed, something was coming out of him, he smiled contentedly. "It's a good way," said the tailor. "God grant that it does him good." The Jew applied 12 leeches to Nikolai, then 12 more, drank tea, and drove away. Nikolai began to tremble. His face turned haggard and, as the women put it, dwindled into a fist. His fingers turned blue. He wrapped himself up in the counterpane and then in a sheepskin coat, but felt colder and colder. Towards evening he was peevish. Asked them to lay him on the floor, asked the tailor not to smoke, and then lay still under the sheepskin. And towards morning, died. Chapter 9. Give alms. It was a rough, a long winter. Since Christmas there had been no grain, and flour was bought outside. Kiryak, who still lived at home, made scenes at night, causing terror to all. And next morning his head ached, and he was ashamed, so that it was painful to see him. Night and day in the stall a hungry cow lowed, and rent the hearts of grandmother and Marya. And to make things worse, the frost grew severer, and the snow heaped itself high in the street, and the winter stretched out. Annunciation was marked by a genuine winter snowstorm, and snow fell in Holy Week. But even this ended. The beginning of April brought warm days and frosty nights. Winter gave way reluctantly, but the hot sunshine foiled him, and at last the brooks melted and the birds began to sing. The fields and shrubs by the riverside were hidden in spring floods, and from Zhukovo to the village beyond stretched a big lake given over to wild duck. The spring sunsets, fiery and with splendid clouds, yielded each day sights new and incredible, sights which are often laughed at when they appear on canvas. The cranes cried mournfully, as if they called on men to follow them. Standing on the brink of the ravine, Olga looked at the flood, at the sun, at the bright, it seemed rejuvenated church, and her tears flowed, and she panted with passionate longing to go away, though it might be to the end of the earth. And indeed it was decided that she should return to Moscow and seek a place as housemaid. And with her would go Kiryak to earn his living as dvornik or somehow else. Ach, to get away soon. When the roads dried and the weather turned hot, they prepared for the journey. Olga and Sasha, with wallets on their backs, both in bast shoes, left at dawn. And Marya came to see them off. Kiryak, ill, remained for a week more. For the last time, Olga prayed towards the church and thought of her husband, and though she didn't cry, her face wrinkled and seemed ugly as an old woman's. During the winter she had grown thinner, uglier, and a little gray. Instead of the old charm and pleasant smile, her face expressed submissiveness and sorrow outlived. And her look was dull and fixed, as if she were deaf. She was sorry to leave the village and the mujiks. She remembered how they carried away Nikolai, how mass was said at nearly every hut, and how all wept, feeling her grief their own. Summer and winter, there were hours and days when it seemed to her that these men lived worse than beasts, and to look at them was terrible. They were coarse, dishonest, dirty, drunken. They lived in discord. They fought eternally because they despised, feared, and suspected one another. Who kept the drink shop and dosed the mujik with drink? The mujik. Who squandered and spent on drink the money of the commune, of the school, of the church? The mujik. Who stole from his neighbor, burnt his house, perjured himself in court for a bottle of vodka? The mujik. Who first spoke at the zemstvo and on other boards against the mujik? The mujik. Yes, to live with them was torture. But despite all this, they were men. They suffered and wept as men. And in their whole lives there was not one act for which an excuse might not be found. Labor unbearable, from which the whole body ached at night, fierce winters, scanty harvests, crowding, help from nowhere, and no hope of help. The richer and the stronger gave no help, because they themselves were rude, dishonest, intemperate, and foul-tongued. The pettiest official or clerk treated the mujiks as vagabonds. Even the cantonal chiefs and church elders addressed them as thou and believed they had a right thereto. Yes. And could there be help or good example from the selfish, the greedy, the dissolute, the idle, who came to these villages with but one intent, to insult, terrify, and rob? Olga remembered the piteous, humiliated faces of the old men when in winter Kiryak was brought out to be flogged. And now she was sorry for all these men and women. And on her last walk through the village, she looked at every hut. When she had accompanied them three versts, Marya said goodbye, then fell upon her knees, and with her face touching the ground, cried loudly. Again I am left alone. Alas, poor me, poor, poor unfortunate. And she continued to keen so that long afterwards Olga and Sasha could see her on her knees, bent on one side, holding her head with her hands. And above her head flew rocks. The sun rose higher. The day grew warm. Zhukovo was left far behind. The travelers followed many circuitous paths, and Olga and Sasha soon forgot the village and Maria. They were in good humor, and everything amused them. First a mound, then a line of telegraph posts with mysterious humming wires which vanished on the horizon and sped to some unknown destination. Then a farm buried in green which sent from afar a smell of dampness and hemp and seemed to say that it was the home of happy people. Then a horse's skeleton lying white in a field. And larks sang untiredly. Quails cried to one another, and the landrail cried with a sound like the drawing of an old boat. At midday Olga and Sasha reached a big village, and in the broad street came upon General Zhukov's old cook. He was hot, and his red, sweating, bald patch shone in the sun. At first he didn't recognize Olga, then he looked and recognized her, but both, without exchanging a word, continued their paths. Olga stopped and bowed low before the open windows of a hut which seemed richer and newer than its neighbors, and cried in a loud, thin, and singing voice, "Orthodox Christians, give alms for the love of Christ, kingdom of heaven to your father and mother, eternal rest." "Orthodox Christians," echoed little Sasha, "give for the love of Christ, heavenly kingdom."
This ends The Peasants, the last story in this collection of five by Anton Pavlovich Chekhov, narrated by George Guidel.